You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rigger. Coming up, downtown Beaver Dam is about to get a makeover. We'll find out about the upcoming Beaver Dam Mural Festival.
Now, paramedics, law enforcement officers, firefighters, and others are generally the first people on the scene when there is an emergency. But the job can take a toll on first responders. Many times it comes in the form of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Under current law, employers are liable for single events that take a mental toll on employees, like they would be for work-related injuries. But a new bill being introduced by Wisconsin lawmakers takes that a step further.
Representative Andre Jacques is one of the state lawmakers behind the bill. He joins us now to tell us more about it. He's a Republican from De Pere. He represents the state's 2nd District. Representative Jacques, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rob. Great to be on the program.
What led you to want to tackle this issue of PTSD and first responders in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, I originally came up with the legislation while talking with law enforcement officers and police chiefs, actually a sheriff as well from my district, that really told me that there was a great need for this, that this is something that, one, you do have a stigma with people accessing the help until it already is manifesting itself, but two, really getting people the treatment and the coping skills to be able to get help for themselves and relationships with their family and get back to work, where they do a fantastic job of protecting all of us while out there on the streets.
So what would change under your proposed legislation?
Well, there's really two key components to the bill. One is that there is actually a requirement for a PTSD diagnosis under workers' comp law. When you're dealing with mental health, it does have to be covered under Wisconsin law, but only if it is of greater dimensions than what would typically be experienced in the workplace. Of course, the situation when you're talking about public safety first responders is that they are dealing with death, danger, and greater or higher stress events than what you typically would expect to experience. So it is something where it also deals with the fact that you have cumulative PTSD, which can occur after repeated exposure to these events, that one single event might not otherwise trigger the symptoms, but that certainly over time, particularly if you don't have the skills to be able to cope, it's something that can result in PTSD. And the other thing it does is it basically says if you are in one of these occupations that, again, is extremely stressful in terms of the day-to-day interactions, there's going to be a presumption that it is arising from your employment. Now, that presumption is still rebuttable by the employer, but it is something that this is something that both actual firefighters, paramedics, law enforcement, as well as the chiefs and people that oversee them in the supervisory structure say is very much needed, and very pleased that I can bring this forward. Very pleased to have Senator Van Wongard as my Senate lead. And we actually at this point have an even number of Republicans and Democrats signed on. We're already at a dozen over the first couple days that we've been circulating it here. So very pleased with that response.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, our current PTSD requirements are kind of based on someone who's in a non-traumatic type of job, and there might be some kind of traumatic incident or tragedy on the job, a one-off event, and that would lead to PTSD and they'd get treatment. This situation obviously very different for people who are dealing with a potentially traumatic situation possibly every day on the job.
Sure, and one of the things that is covered under current law is if you do have a mental health disorder that results from a physical injury, if you can show that basically somebody who gets seriously injured and then maybe would develop PTSD as a result of that, then there is going to be some coverage. But I think it's something where when you have individuals who on a regular day might be dealing with suicide or a hostage-taking situation and domestic violence dispute or fire, anytime where you're going to have death and danger, and you know, it's something that you know, just the violent nature of the situations that our first responders are responding to, I think should be worthy of that presumption that it is resulting from their employment in that situation.
We're talking to State Assembly Representative Andre Jacques, Republican from De Pere, looking at new legislation he is authoring and sponsoring aimed at helping first responders get access to treatment for PTSD from trauma they might sustain over the course of their job, over maybe multiple incidents over time. Now, this puts requirements on employers. Representative Jacques, this would potentially create costs. The employers in these cases are municipal and county governments, I would imagine. What kind of cost issues do you see in this legislation?
Well, I have asked for a preliminary fiscal estimate from the state. I have not received that back yet, but I assume that we'll have that probably even before the bill is done circulating. But I think really this legislation is intended to do what I think a lot of people would expect would already be the case when it comes to dealing with workplace-related workers' compensation issues for people in a very dangerous occupation. And, I mean, I don't know how significant the cost increase would be, you know, in terms of people that are responsible for the claims and insurance coverage. But I think to the extent that there are increased costs, I think people that deal at the local level with public safety and the sacrifices that are made by our protectors, our first responders, I think they're going to say that it's well worth it, and something that certainly, you know, workers' compensation is set up so that the employer is responsible for whether it's a mental injury or disease or a physical situation that results, and that's the employer's responsibility because their employment is subjecting you to that situation. And I think certainly when you have first responders, clearly this is when you have a clinical PTSD diagnosis, you're going to see it generally arising from the circumstances of their employment in that very, very dangerous line of work, unfortunately.
As I understand it, our neighbors in Minnesota have been tackling PTSD among first responders. Two lawmakers there pushing to make it a recognized workplace illness. Are you seeing these things happen in other states around the country? Are you getting inspired by similar legislation elsewhere?
You know, there are a variety of different legislative efforts, I know, in Colorado and Florida, and it's very difficult to compare state to state because some things just don't translate across state borders in the way that there might be reimbursement or overall coverage. In a lot of ways, Wisconsin actually is better than a number of other states, but the point is that we can be better here in Wisconsin, and certainly when you're talking about for public safety professionals, this is something that I just think makes a lot of sense. This isn't out of line with, I think, the direction that most states are heading. It's just something that I think we clearly need to take a look at making this change.
You mentioned that some of the impetus came from talking to leadership in first responder agencies of various sorts. What kind of stories were you hearing from people?
Well, and without getting too much into it, I can just say that I deal a lot with law enforcement. I deal a lot with victims' rights and legislation that comes from public safety, and that can be everything from domestic violence and sexual assault to hit and runs. And I'm always looking for ideas. And this is an idea that came out to me a while back, and I actually was talking to a police chief in my district about wanting to honor one of his officers with the Hometown Hero Award. This particular officer is somebody that has actually on four separate occasions saved the lives of citizens while responding to incidents. And it was at that point that I found out about how this individual, this officer, and spoke to him on a few occasions, is unfortunately dealing with PTSD and not receiving the support that he should be able to receive in terms of being able to get the treatment that's available to get him those coping skills to be able to be much healthier in his personal life and get back on the job protecting the rest of us. And so it is something where there's really a personal element to really pretty much all of the bills that I introduce. And it is something that certainly, I'm always looking for suggestions from people on the front lines in any occupation, but this is one that came to me as a suggestion, and certainly I think there was a very telling personal story as to the actual impact, and something that I've heard many more of since I began working on this legislation. I can tell you that this is something that is very deeply felt, that actually has been a priority for a lot of other people. I know that there are at least three other lawmakers that were interested in working on this issue but really didn't know quite where to start. was pleased that the drafting attorney that I happened to be working with had a few suggestions, and it is something that, you know, this is not partisan legislation. This is just common sense, and I think for the good of the folks that put themselves at risk and sacrifice and write a blank check to be out there protecting us.
Briefly, as we wrap up, you mentioned bipartisan support. Do you have a timeline for advancing this?
Well, I mean, I think really we're looking at the fall in terms of when there would be any sort of possible floor votes, committee votes, but I'm hoping that we can get this introduced and have hearings in the Assembly and Senate sometime over the summer, and certainly expect we'll at least be able to advance the dialogue that way and go from there, depending on what kind of broader legislative support we see. But it is something that I do think has a lot of support from my colleagues, have not really come into any difficulty so far. So hopefully we'll keep it moving. But we've got almost 2 weeks left in the circulation period, and then, of course, it has to get referred to a committee and work out with other committee schedules that way.
Representative Jacques, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for the invitation.
That's Andre Jacques, Republican from Napier. He represents Wisconsin's 2nd Assembly District. He joined us to talk about a new bill that tries to help first responders suffering from PTSD.
The town of Beaver Dam is hosting a 5-day mural painting festival later this month. The festival represents years of planning and is part of an effort to revitalize downtown Beaver Dam.
The task at hand, 15 historically themed murals will be painted over 5 days by over 100 artists from the U.S. and around the world, all part of a mural painting artist group called the Wall Dogs. The festival begins June 28th and runs through July 2nd.
Jessalyn Brown joins us now. She's a wall dog herself and director of the Beaver Dam Arts Association. Jessalyn, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
Well, how did this idea of this mural painting festival, how did it first come about?
I believe it was several years, actually, before I moved to Beaver Dam that it was sort of underway. They had contacted the wall dogs. They had seen some other towns that had had the effect of the wall dogs in Wisconsin. And they placed a phone call to see if Beaver Dam would be the type of city that the Wall Dogs would come to help with revitalization efforts, is really what it is.
And, Jessalyn, you're one of the Wall Dogs. This is this big mural painting group, apparently with members from all over the place. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Wall Dogs and how they function?
Sure. I've been painting with them for about 3 years, and it's really just a group that gets together once a year, once or twice a year, I should say. During the summer, a lot of the other wall dogs are sign painters, hand letterers that do hand lettered signs, and they get together once a year to help a city. They paint for free. They come and they all get together. It's kind of like a big family reunion.
Now, you've been working with Eric Dittman, president of Downtown Beaver Dam, Inc., who spearheaded that festival. What has he told you about what the process was like bringing this mural festival to Beaver Dam?
Sure. He is on the line, so I'll let him tell you.
Eric, are you with us?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm right here.
Oh, excellent. We weren't sure that you had made it on. Well, Eric, glad to have you with us. Can you tell us about this process?
Yeah, well, it started back in 2010, actually. Somebody just had the idea of murals, and then somebody discovered the Wall Dogs. But throughout the process, beyond that, it's getting volunteers and getting ideas for the murals, getting fundraising. We've had to raise close to $100,000 just for all the costs and equipment, and a lot of it's donated. But there's just a lot of details that everyone in the community has come together to make it happen.
What did you like about this idea of murals? As you're thinking downtown revitalization, what made you think, you know, murals would really help?
Well, if public art's got a lot of power, it can show people what's possible. It beautifies the downtown area, and it, in the process, encourages people to invest more in their buildings if they're building owners, but also just gives them a reason to come downtown.
So, Jessalyn, did you have to get permission from building owners? Did you have to get people to sign off and say, yeah, I'll host a giant mural on the side of my building?
Yeah, absolutely. We had to do a lot of that, a lot of legwork. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes work that happens with these festivals. Not only that, but securing equipment, making sure the buildings are in the proper shape that they'll last, that the murals will continue to last for years. Also that, you know, if the building owners sell the building, you know, what happens then? So there's a lot of paperwork involved, too.
Did you meet with some reluctance, or for the most part, were people pretty happy to see this thing happen?
I think they're very excited. We have 15 murals that are secured, and everyone is really excited.
And Eric, can you tell us about those 15 murals? What is the design process like? How did you decide on 15 and what the subject matter is?
Sure. Well, it came to how far we were on funding and what we thought we could continue to fund. And so we just started with that and then looked through our history, got a lot of help from the local historical society here in Dodge County, the librarians, local historians, and just as a committee came up with the subjects that were the most appropriate.
And these are historically themed, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Can you tell us about one or two of the themes?
Sure. I think a good one a lot of people will like is on Ziegler Beer. It was a local brewery here that lasted until 1953. And that's actually being designed by a German gentleman from Bavaria. And it just depicts a couple of the labels and just the feel of that brand from back in the late 1800s.
Oh, nice.
And we've also got a really neat feature on glider pilots of World War II. That's our veterans theme, and actually depicts a couple local gentlemen in the mural as well.
We're speaking right now with Eric Didman, president of Downtown Beaver Dam, Inc., the revitalization group spearheading this Beaver Dam Mural Festival. And Jessalyn Brown is with us, too, director of the Beaver Dam Arts Association. She's also one of the mural artists from the group Wall Dogs, and she's on the committee for the upcoming Beaver Dam Mural Festival called Decorate the Dam. And Jessalyn, tell us a little bit about this festival and how the public can get involved.
Yeah, we have over 100 and some volunteers, people that are already ready to help out just locally. And the artists descend Wednesday evening on our town. We have a welcome dinner. And then after that, as soon as the sun goes down, they'll project the mural images onto the walls and do sort of a sketch outline drawing on each of the sites. So we'll also have the streetlights dimmed or off. So you can kind of walk around and see what's going on there. And then Thursday, they paint all day, and we have different activities for the community members. So when they're walking around the 15 mural sites checking on progress, there's other things that will be happening. They paint all day Friday, and Saturday they are usually finishing up, weather permitting, for the whole festival. And then we have a big celebration dinner Saturday night as well.
That's a good point. What do you do if it rains?
Yeah, well, they still paint mostly. We have different tarps and things. If it's a sideways downpour, you just have to stop for a while. Mm. We do use acrylic paint, so it dries pretty quickly. So there's no, like, if it rains on it, it won't run, right away.
And, Eric, this has been something that other communities in Wisconsin have done with this mural painting group, the Wall Dogs. What kind of interest have they seen, and have you heard feedback from those communities about how this affected the way that their areas felt, their town felt, and the sense of community?
Yeah, absolutely. Plymouth, Wisconsin is probably the one that comes to mind immediately. They've turned into a tourist hub. They were before, but it's just further enhanced their ability to attract people to come. I'm not sure exactly how many they have, but I think they have over 20 murals in Plymouth. And Delavan, Wisconsin's another one. They've seen building owners invest more in the downtown district as a result of the festival. But prior to, they did a bunch of work to make the walls in better shape. And so it just spurs a lot of activity that, for each community, it's different. You never know what could come from it.
Oh, it sounds like an exciting time. And in terms of what you think downtown Beaver Dam needs, is this something that's been on the list for a while to revitalize it? What do you think has been missing, in a sense?
Yeah, I think that sense of what do we do to be known for, as downtown districts struggle to find an identity, really, this is just a perfect thing for us to build off of, reflecting on our history and giving people that reason to come downtown.
Let's take a caller now. You can chime in on this. Sherry is with us from Elkhorn. Sherry, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
I live in Elkhorn, but Delavan is just a little south of us, and they did this in Delavan a couple years ago. It's a phenomenal thing to see, and the murals are just beautiful.
It sounds like the proof is in the pudding in Delavan already. Sherry, thank you so much for calling. And Jessalyn, is there a big call for towns like Beaver Dam, like Delavan, to have the Wild Dogs come in and make some art?
Absolutely. I was in Delavan and worked on one of those murals there, and that was a great time, a great city. And I think, yeah, there are more cities, and I think the Wild Dogs are kind of overwhelmed. They started doing two festivals a year now. For the past 2 years, because there's so much need and so many people are interested, and it is across the country. The one later this summer will be in Rhode Island.
And Eric, if people want to get involved, want to come see it, what do they need to know?
Just come on down for the festival. Really, there's things going all over the place. You can see more information on our website at bddowntown.com. We've got a full map of all the sites and a full event schedule. It's really just come and participate and watch.
Terrific. Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, of course. Thank you.
That was Eric Didman, president of Downtown Beaver Dam, Inc., and Jessalyn Brown also with us. Jessalyn, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jessalyn is the director of the Beaver Dam Arts Association. She's a Wild Dog mural artist herself and on the committee for this upcoming festival called Decorate the Dam. And if you'd like to see it in action, see art being made, you can check out that festival. It begins June 28th and runs through July 2nd.
Coming up, news broke last night that President Trump is reportedly under investigation for possible obstruction of justice. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's True Stories Told Live on the Moth Radio Hour. In this special episode celebrating fathers, a man embraces his father's music, a new dad has a breakdown in the grocery store, a young father struggles with his emotions, and an uncle steps in to play an important role. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, the Washington Post reported last night that special counsel Robert Mueller is investigating President Trump to see whether he obstructed the ongoing Russia investigation.
Officials told the Post that Trump is under federal investigation for potentially attempting to obstruct justice. Special counsel Robert Mueller has been overseeing the probe into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. According to the report, Mueller plans to interview three senior intelligence officers.
Trump was told privately by former FBI Director James Comey that he was not under investigation. According to the Post, that changed after Comey was abruptly fired.
Barbara McQuaid joins us now to tell us more. She teaches at the University of Michigan Law School and was formerly U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. She stepped down after Attorney General Jeff Sessions asked for her and 45 other U.S. attorneys' resignations. Barbara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
How significant is this report that the investigation is looking into President Trump and concerns of obstruction of justice?
Well, it's a serious matter. I think it's not really surprising in light of what we've been learning in recent weeks when James Comey testified last week and talked about the facts known to him and made reference to this will be for Robert Mueller to determine. I think most of us probably concluded that there was an investigation underway, but I think now it's pretty clear that it is.
What is the standard that they'd have to meet to say, yes, this is in fact obstruction of justice?
Well, the elements of the offense are where someone corruptly acts to impede or obstruct an investigation. It has to be an official proceeding. And so the trickiest part of making one of those cases is demonstrating that word corruptly. You have to show that the person acted with a bad purpose or motive. And that can be tricky because, as a jury would be instructed, you can't read someone's mind. So you have to rely on all of the facts, what they said, what they did, so that you can draw reasonable inferences as to what their intent was.
And the firing of James Comey seems to be one of the big questions here, why the president fired him. We've seen the president's tweets used in recent court cases related to the travel ban. Would the president's statement that he was thinking of the Russia investigation while deciding to fire James Comey, is that something that could play into whether this is obstruction of justice?
It certainly could be a piece of evidence. I think it's admissible evidence as under the hearsay rules, a statement against interest. But I think it's one of the pieces that goes into this story. You know, I think the shifting explanations, as Jim Comey put it, for his termination, I think are one of the most important things. In the law, there's a phrase, consciousness of guilt. When you tell lots of different stories about what really happened, that could be consciousness of guilt, that you knew one thing was proper and something else wasn't. So the pretextual perhaps explanations that the reason for the termination at first was the handling of the Clinton email investigation and later coming out that it was in fact relating to the Russia investigation. I think all of that goes into the mix into trying to determine what was on the president's mind when he took this action.
According to these reports, the investigators want to talk to three different intelligence officials. What kind of things, again, given that we can't read their minds, but what kind of things do you think they're hoping to find out?
Well, there have been media reports that said that President Trump asked them, just as he asked Comey, if they could help to end the Flynn investigation. Now, they refused to answer those questions in front of Congress, but in front of a grand jury with a subpoena and potential for a compulsion order, they very well may and likely would answer those questions. So I think the kind of things he's going to want to find out is, can he either confirm or refute what Jim Comey had to say? And if they repeat what Jim Comey said, that is, that President Trump asked them to see if they could persuade the FBI to end the Flynn investigation, then I think you no longer have what is being characterized as a he said situation. You now have a he said they said situation. If you have three or four different witnesses all telling the same story, then it becomes much more compelling.
In the hypothetical instance that Robert Mueller and his staff conclude that, yes, indeed, there was obstruction of justice, then what? They can't indict a president, or can they?
Well, it's not clear. It seems that the best source we have on this is some advisory opinions issued by the Justice Department, both during the Watergate era and during the era when President Clinton was under impeachment. It appears from those opinions that a sitting president cannot be indicted on the theory that it would interfere too much with his duties to lead the country. But the mechanism for ending the presidency is impeachment, so Robert Mueller could turn over a final report to the Justice Department to the House Judiciary Committee, which would be the one with authority to begin impeachment proceedings, and the Senate would then be the decision maker. Now, here's the question. If he is removed from office, could you then indict him and charge him criminally, facing potential prison charges, after he leaves office, as long as the statute of limitations is not met? I would suggest that you can.
Talking to Barbara McQuaid from the University of Michigan Law School, former U.S. attorney, looking at the latest news on the investigation of Russian interference in the election, President Trump, obstruction of justice, and more. Barbara, Robert Mueller is in this job. Floated the idea of firing him. A friend of President Trump said the president was thinking of it. There's been reporting, but not solid. What would go into that? What would be the reaction if the president tried to fire Robert Mueller?
Well, it seems like it would be just a political nightmare for him, but I guess that hasn't stopped him from doing things before that he wants to do. You know, under the law, it appears that only the attorney general has the authority to appoint and terminate a special counsel. And to terminate requires just cause. So it appears that the president would have to direct the acting attorney general on this matter, who is Rod Rosenstein, to fire Robert Mueller. Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, testified yesterday in front of Congress that he wouldn't do that unless he saw just cause. He's not aware of any. So it would seem unlikely. If Trump wanted to do it himself, then perhaps there could be some challenge. Now, it's only a regulation. It's not a statute. It's not a constitutional matter that says it's only the Attorney General who could do it. So we could have a little legal battle on our hands to figure out whether he does or does not have authority to fire the special counsel.
This obstruction of justice investigation is just one slice of the overall investigation. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the other elements. Russian interference in the election is where this all started. What kind of things are, and it seems like everybody agrees that this probably happened, what kind of things would they be investigating now?
Yeah, and this really is the thing that we should be most concerned about. Of course, it's very concerning if a president tried to obstruct that investigation. And if he did, that's what makes it such a serious matter, because we absolutely want to know if the Russians were interfering with our elections. That is the cornerstone of our democracy. So what are the kinds of things they're looking for? I would think direct cyber hacking. I have read some reports that there was no change in the outcome of ballots cast, but there may have been efforts to hack into voter registration databases, which could have had an impact on who was allowed to vote on Election Day. Certainly there was propaganda spread by sharing the private emails of members of the Clinton campaign and the DNC in attempts to discredit them and just create some chaos within that campaign. So those are things that they would look at. And then, of course, whether there was any collusion by anybody on the Trump campaign. You know, sometimes there are witting beneficiaries, and sometimes they're unwitting. So it may be that members of the Trump campaign assisted, believing they were assisting in some financial matters, and unwittingly assisted in the campaign. So all of those things, I think, would be in the scope of what Robert Mueller is investigating.
We're talking to Barbara McQuaid, professor at the University of Michigan Law School, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, looking at the news that President Trump is reportedly under investigation for potentially obstructing justice.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of Robert Mueller's decision to look into whether the president tried to obstruct justice? What do you expect to come out of it? And how do you think the president's decision to fire former FBI Director James Comey could be affecting this, if at all? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation now with Barbara McQuaid, professor at the University of Michigan Law School, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, looking at the reported investigation of President Trump for possible obstruction of justice.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you think of an investigation into whether the president tried to obstruct justice is a good idea. Does this change your opinion of the president? Why or why not? And does it change how you see the Russian involvement in the U.S. election? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to our callers. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. Okay. What also throws a monkey wrench into it, at least, is Jeff Sessions recused himself from the Russian interference investigation. But if Jeff Sessions would be the only one who would be allowed to fire Robert Mueller, how could Jeff Sessions fire Robert Mueller?
Dennis, thanks for the call. So it would actually be Rod Rosenstein acting as the Attorney General for this case. Do I have that right, Barbara?
Yes, so I think so. Because Attorney General Sessions recused himself from anything relating to either of the campaigns was the specific basis of the recusal. Because of that, it was Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein who appointed Robert Mueller as the special counsel, and he would be the one who has authority to fire him. So that's the person that we would look to. Now, if he was given an order by the president, you know, there have been some comparisons to the Saturday night massacre during Watergate, you know, we could see what happened then where one official after another refused to execute the order and resigned. So you could see something like that, I suppose, because Rosenstein has said that he will not fire Mueller in the absence of just cause.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Chris with us in Pulaski. Chris, hi.
Hello. I mean, it's a little related, I guess, but it is related. I'm confused on the Russians hacked in. To what did they hack into, and how could it even have affected the election, number one? And then, because that's, I mean, basically that's the root of all this stuff.
Chris, your line's breaking up a little bit, but the gist, I think I got Barbara. What did the Russians really do, supposedly? What could they have done that actually affected the election?
Yeah, so what we do know, and what the intelligence agencies have confirmed, is that there were hacks into the Democratic National Committee, and John Podesta, who was a campaign chairman of Hillary Clinton, and you may recall during the election we saw these coming out in dribs and drabs in an effort to undermine that campaign. That was an effort to sort of turn the electorate and sway voters. But the other question is, were there actual hacks into voting software? To date, there has been no finding that any votes were changed, but there has been some reporting that voter registration databases may have been hacked into. So, you know, you might have shown up at the polls and said, "Hi, I'm here to vote." And they might have said, "Sorry, you're not registered in this precinct," which could have accounted for low voter turnout.
Thanks for that call, Barbara. I wanted to ask about one more angle on this investigation. Possible financial crimes could fall into the scope either of the president or then candidate Trump himself, or people associated with his campaign. What could the mandate of this investigation include?
Yeah, it does seem clear that they are investigating financial matters. Flynn allegedly accepted funds. It was involved in some financial transactions with not only the government of Russia, but the government of Turkey. Paul Manafort was a lobbyist for Russia. So there could be looking at some of those kinds of things to see if anybody there's a crime to be acting as an agent of a foreign government without notifying the United States government of that activity. So that could be a crime. I noticed when James Comey was testifying, he was asked about this Russian bank called VEB and what he knows about it. And he says, "Well, all I can tell you in this setting is that it exists." But it certainly suggested that he knew more that he could not discuss in an open setting. So I'm sure there's going to be investigation into that. There's been some reporting that Jared Kushner has ties to that bank. And so I would imagine that all of those things would be within the scope of the special counsel's investigation.
Now, the basis for our conversation today is the report that the special counsel is investigating the president himself. We're not technically, I think, supposed to know that. Something got leaked somewhere. Trump supporters and his personal attorney are pointing attention to that. How much should we be worried about leaks coming out of this investigation?
Leaks are a very serious thing. You know, leak is a term that is used, I think, more in the media and by lay people. It's not a legal term. So there are leaks, and there are leaks. Someone who talks about something that's going on is one thing. The things that we really should be concerned about are the disclosure of classified information. That's a very serious matter, and there has been reporting about a foreign intelligence warrant that intercepted the communications of Carter Page, who was working on the Trump campaign. The fact that that's been disclosed in the media, to me, is a very serious matter. And if someone were caught doing that, that could be grounds for criminal prosecution. But other things, sharing information with the press about what's happening within your organization, may be poor form. It may be not permitted under the rules of the office, but is not criminal per se.
And it's not clear from the Washington Post report. It looks like it may be information not from the special counsel's office, but from people in agencies associated with people who were being interviewed, kind of trying to read between the lines there. But does that matter who the leak comes from in this instance?
It does. Under the grand jury secrecy rules, attorneys for the government are not permitted to share grand jury material, and that would include the entire prosecution team, so including the FBI agents. And you can be held in contempt of the grand jury with criminal penalties for disclosing anything about matters coming before the grand jury. But those rules don't apply to witnesses called before the grand jury. And so oftentimes I've been involved in these situations where there were so-called grand jury leaks, and everyone starts pointing to the prosecutors and the FBI, who, believe me, are the last people who want this stuff to come out because they don't want anything to undermine the integrity of their investigation. They don't want people knowing what they're doing until they're done. But the witnesses, or people who know the witnesses, or people who have seen these subpoenas, may be the sources of those leaks.
We'll leave it there for now. Barbara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
We've been talking to Barbara McQuaid. She teaches at the University of Michigan Law School. She was formerly a U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Michigan. She joined us to look at news of President Trump reportedly being under investigation for obstruction of justice by Special Counsel Robert Mueller.
We're happy to report that Wisconsin Public Radio talk show host Larry Mueller is being inducted into the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association Hall of Fame today. The award honors his 50-year career at WPR.
Over the decades, listeners have appreciated his insatiable curiosity and smiled along with his infectious laugh heard every weekday here on the Ideas Network. Our colleague Kate Archer-Kent talked to Larry about being the station's longest-serving host.
Let's go back to where your career started on the air. It's 1967. We're in the throes of the Vietnam War. Lyndon B. Johnson is president. And how does your radio career unfold in 1967?
Well, I was a graduate student in the Department of Agricultural Journalism. Actually, I was an undergraduate student. And I took a course in radio from Maury White in my senior year. Maury was going to Colorado for the summer and needed someone to do his half-hour radio show. So he said, how would you like to go on for a master's degree? And then you could do my radio show for me and get your master's. And I didn't have any job prospects. So I said, well, that sounds interesting. Sounds like a good idea.
A decade goes by and you have this new program, Wisconsin Here and Now. And you started taking callers in 1978. Do you remember that first call?
I had two veterinarians on. And I'm wondering if anybody's going to call Grace Pearson, who subsequently, later, she called many, many times. She was from Stevens Point, Wisconsin. And I'm waiting for that question. And she says, how do I tell if my cat is a male or a female? And the vet said, well, you pick up its tail. That was the first question. I'm kind of off and running from there and just having a lot of fun, but I think also getting a lot of pretty good information out to people.
You've been described as the friendly host who has kitchen table conversations. Do you see yourself that way?
Yeah, I think so. I'm more or less off air the way I am on the air. I'm curious about things. I don't think I'm pretentious at all. I, you know, was raised to be respectful to people, and I think I'm respectful to my audience.
Did you receive some good advice along the way that's stuck with you?
Be prepared. Once, a long time ago, I was interviewing a person who was supposed to talk about how to deal with stress. And so I had read some things on it beforehand, and she was quite good beforehand. We got her in the studio, and then I asked her the first question, and she kind of stressed out herself, and her mouth opened, and nothing came out. So I said, you know, before you answer that question, let me take a crack at that. And so I answered my own question, and then I asked her another one, and I actually answered that one. And then somebody had already called and asked a question, and I sort of answered their question. And at that point, something finally clicked with her, and, you know, then she was fine the rest of the show, and I got a lot of mail on it, and the gist of every one of the comments was, why don't you let your guests do the talking? Why are you answering those questions?
You can't win, Larry.
But it's, you know, it does go to being prepared.
How have you given back and left your mark in broadcasting?
I've been able to pass on a lot of great information, not things that I necessarily knew, but what my guests knew to people. And I think my goal has always been to have fun and have our listeners have fun, but also have them learn something. And I think of anything I've done, I think I've been able to pass on a fair amount of learning.
Larry Mueller had a whole lot more to say to Kate, if you can imagine, about attending a one-room schoolhouse, hosting Santa and his elves on his show, and where he learned so much about gardening. You can find the extended interview over at WPR.org.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a guest makes the case that Wisconsin dairy policies favor large-scale livestock operations at the expense of smaller farms.
We'll check out the news that Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman is not seeking re-election next year as part of our weekly roundup of some of the top news stories from around Wisconsin.
And on Food Friday, from toast to guacamole and beyond, we'll cook with one of my favorite ingredients that I didn't know was quite so versatile. versatile as it turns out to be, the lovely and green avocado.
And hopefully we'll get some avocado safety tips along the way. There have been issues. There have been issues out there when it
avocado
comes to
hand.
Avocados. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.